Sirisha actually had emailed me about printing off the PowerPoint slides. You had trouble, right, Sirisha? Were you able to print it off? Okay. How many people are still having trouble with those files? I've tried everything. I've flattened the file. I've done all. You're having trouble printing the file as well? And then, okay. So that's a strategy. If you can't print directly, print to PDF first and then print again. Pain in the neck, but I really don't know what's going on. I've tried every conceivable thing. After 2 hours, I finally gave up. Okay. So today, as with every other class, we're going to start with the start of the class test. And again, it's going to be intimidating if you've never done valuation, but kind of go back to basics. Because as I said, everything we're going to talk about in this class, you already know. So we're going to kind of unearth what you already know. So this is actually from a valuation that's about 35 years old. And I'll tell you why I went back that far in a few minutes. But this is a valuation done of a company called Carborundum. So let me give you some history. This was actually a valuation for an acquisition. And the acquiring company was a company called Kennecott. It was a copper mining company that had a coal mining subsidiary. And because of antitrust laws in the late 70s, it was forced to sell its coal mining subsidiary. It sold it. It got $600 million in cash, which created an immediate problem for it. You think, what's the problem with having $600 million in cash? It was a $3 billion company. $600 million came in, and they got really nervous about something happening to them. So what was Kennecott so nervous about? This is going to kill them. Does anybody know where this drilling is coming from? Is it coming from upstairs, downstairs? Okay. You know what? I'll be back in 1 minute. Excuse me. Sorry. Push the door. You guys can't drill it. The class going on right upstairs. So please, until about noon, you can't do this, okay? Because I can't teach. Okay, so I think we're all set. Okay. So let me go back. So Kennecott had to sell off this coal subsidiary, got $600 million in cash, and that's 20% of the company. So what do you think they were afraid of? Of being taken over, right? So you got $600 million in cash that you have absolutely no use for. You're worried about being taken over. What's the most logical way to get rid of that $600 million in cash? Give it back to shareholders, right? That thought never even crossed their minds. But what would shareholders do with the cash? Stupid things like pay their bills, buy a house, something like that. They said, we can't allow that to happen. We have to get rid of the $600 million quickly, but we can't give it to the shareholders. Let me ask you the second question. What's the quickest way to get rid of $600 million in cash from your balance sheet? If you don't want to give it back to your shareholders, do an acquisition. And that's exactly what they planned to do. So they went to First Boston, at that time the leading M&A bank on the street, and said, we'd like to do an acquisition. Can you help us? And of course, you know what the answer was. Of course we can. And we'll find you the perfect target company. And this was the target company that they came back with. A company called Carborundum that made abrasives. It's still around. And First Boston valued Carborundum for them. And they said, coincidentally, you'll be able to buy this company for exactly the amount of cash you have on your balance sheet. That's another thing to remember about acquisitions. You tell the banker how much you want to spend, and coincidentally, whatever they show you will be exactly what you have to spend. What magic that is. So this was the valuation that First Boston did to back up the valuation. So remember, Kennecott's paying $600 million. First Boston valued Carborundum at $660 million. This was the valuation that backed up the $660 million. Now, most acquisition valuations go into files and folders and get locked away for posterity. You never get to see them, even the biggest mistakes. This, unfortunately for First Boston, made its way into a Harvard case study. And the advantage of being in a Harvard case study is nobody talks about the numbers anyway. So you put an exhibit. You never say, you're supposed to browse through it, but then go back to the big strategic questions. So people said, well, nobody would even look at the numbers anyway. But I took a look at the numbers to see whether the valuation of $660 million was backed up by the numbers they provided. So I'm going to describe how they estimated cash flows for Carborundum. Remember, Carborundum is the target company. Kennecott is the acquiring company. And then I'm going to ask you a very simple but a very, very important question in acquisitions about what discount rate I should apply in the cash flows. So let me describe how they came up with the cash flows. So these are the cash flows to Carborundum. They started with revenues, obviously. They subtracted out expenses, including interest expenses, to come up with net income. So that's already, I'm giving away some clues about where I'm going. So they're starting with net income, which is equity income. Then they subtract out CapEx, change in working capital, and debt repayments to come up with their cash flows. So you start with net income. You subtract out debt repayments and reinvestment, you come up with the cash flow. So that's the cash flow they're discounting. Now comes here the question I have for you. Forget about the specifics. I mean, I don't even want to contest their assumptions about what revenue growth and margins. I'll concede them to First Boston. The only question I have for you is what discount rate would I apply? And I'll give you six choices. In fact, I'll give you nine different choices. Three choices I haven't shown there, but I'll bring them in as well. I could use either the cost of equity or the cost of capital. I could use, actually, let's keep it at six choices. Six is enough. I could use the acquiring company's cost of equity or the acquiring company's cost of capital, the target company's cost of equity or the target company's cost of capital, or the combined company's cost of equity or the combined company's cost of capital. Very different numbers, right? So which of these six discount rates, given what I just told you about how they estimated cash flows, which of these six discount rates should I use? Let's start with at least with the first choice. Cost of equity or cost of capital? Tell me why.
Because your cash flows were to equity holders.
And tell me what made them cash flows to equity holders.
You started with net income and you also took out.
In other words, it started with net income, which is after interest expense, then I took out debt payment, so it's a cash flow to equity because it's after cash flows to debt. That's it. There's no if, maybe, no. It's a cash flow to equity. So cross the line through the cost of capital. None of the cost of capital apply. Now let me pick on somebody who's planning to work in M&A after you graduate. Some of you probably have a job offer coming out of summer, right, in M&A. Anybody want to volunteer? I'll make a deal with you. If you get the answer right, it's not a very good deal because it's a one-sided deal. I'll make a promise. You're going to be okay in M&A. But if you don't get this number right, maybe you should reconsider whether you really want to go in M&A. So nobody wants to volunteer, huh? So let me throw the question open to everybody in the class. Now I have to pick between three different costs of equity. Acquiring company cost of equity, target company cost of equity, combined company cost of equity. Which of those three costs of equities is most relevant given the cash flows that I'm discounting?
The targets.
The target company's cost of equity. Let me play devil's advocate. But Kennecott is coming up with the money. It's their stockholders' equity. Why shouldn't I attach Kennecott's cost of equity? The acquiring company's coming up with the capital.
Carborundum's cost of equity reflects the riskiness of the cash flows.
It goes back to corporate finance. I don't know whether you remember. Remember the Disney theme park? You should, because I obsessed about it for like three sessions. Even if you weren't in my corporate finance class, you kind of get this as we go along. That was a project for Disney. And the point we made is if you're looking at a project, the cost of capital or cost of equity used to discount the cash flows shouldn't reflect the risk of the entity looking at the project, but the riskiness of the project itself. Now, part of you saying, it's not a project, it's an acquisition. What do you think an acquisition is? It's a gigantic project. So it cannot be the cost of equity of the acquiring firm because they have nothing to do with this. It cannot be the cost of equity of the merged firm because that has nothing to do with it either. This is like a project. You're looking at the cash flows. You look at the risk in those cash flows. You get a discount rate based on that risk. You're done. The cost of equity for Carborundum should have been the discount rate that First Boston used in the valuation. Let me ask you another question. What's the worst possible choice you could make in terms of a discount rate? How far away can you get from the right answer? What's the worst possible answer? First, pick cost of capital rather than cost of equity. Then pick the acquiring company's cost of capital rather than the target company's whatever. That's exactly what First Boston used. It's 10.5% cost of capital. And for this, you get a merger fee? What am I paying you for? This is violating one of the first principles in corporate finance, and there are no ifs and buts. There are no exceptions to this rule. This is a fundamental rule, and they're not alone. Half of all acquisition valuations are screwed up at that first stage. Wrong company's discount rate, there's nothing else to talk about. The rest is academic. So one of the things we're going to talk about today is that consistency principle, which means that just because you have a D and a CF doesn't mean you have a DCF. You know what I mean? You see cash flows, I've got a discount rate, I've got a discounted cash flow valuation. You can have horrible DCFs and sensible DCFs. So if you want to know what discount, so if I ask you what discount rate should I use in the cash flows, the first question you need to ask me is how did you estimate the cash flow? Starting with what currency? Is it a cash flow to equity or cash flow to the firm? Because only then can you apply the right discount rate. So file this away. And there's one more point I want to make. I told you First Boston was the leading M&A bank on the street in 1979. It had two co-heads of the M&A department. You know what the names were? I talked about them a little bit in the first session, or the second session. Bruce Wasserstein and Joe Perella. They co-headed. And the punishment they got for all the awful valuations they did was they started their own boutique called Wasserstein Perella. And they screwed up valuations so much that they got punished by Dresner buying out Wasserstein Perella. And I can't make this stuff up. But they paid $2 billion, and in the press release, they said they were paying it for Wasserstein Perella's valuation expertise. You can't make this stuff up. What expertise? It's a violation of first principles. Evaluation is going to fall apart just because of that. In fact, I took their numbers, didn't change a single assumption, changed just the discount rate to the right discount rate from 10.5 to 16.5. The value that I got was $450 million. What did Kennicott pay? $600 million. You've just advised a client to pay $150 million more than your own estimate of value just because you screwed up on the discount rate. Now, part of you is saying, well, they probably knew this. They did this just to get the deal done. I don't think so. Because here's what happens in a lot of valuations. There's a discount rate team whose job it is to come up with a discount rate. You know how you work in teams? So you division of labor because you've got to get the numbers done by midnight. So one half of the team works on discount rates. The other half of the team works on cash flows. They don't meet until about 3 minutes before the deadline. The Excel spreadsheet comes together. The only problem is since they didn't talk to each other, the discount rates and the cash flows don't match up now. So this is something we're going to come back to over and over again about consistency. Hopefully you'll remember that just because there's a big name attached to a valuation, whether it's Goldman Sachs or KKR, don't assume that, it's not even a question of assumptions, don't assume that first principles are being followed. So let me – So let me go back to the last few pieces of the introduction to valuation that I hadn't got to. And then we'll move on to today's topic. So last session I talked about intrinsic valuation. And if you remember intrinsic valuation, I said philosophically you're trying to estimate what the value of a company, a business, or an asset is. And you're assuming that markets make mistakes and correct them over time. In relative valuation, I said you've given up on estimating intrinsic value. You value an asset based on how similar assets are priced out there. And then you make the assumption that markets make mistakes on average. They don't make mistakes on average, but they make mistakes on individual companies. And I closed off with asset-based valuation, which is what accounting valuation is, some of the parts. And I said it's really not a different valuation approach. It's a subset of one of the first two approaches. So you don't even have to answer this for the moment, but if you have a prior that you come in with already, however ill-formed it might be, make a choice right now and keep it to yourself. So say, given what I know about valuation right now, if I had to pick, I'd pick valuing something using a discounted cash flow model, or I'd pick valuing it by looking at how other assets are priced. File that away. Because at the end of the last class, the December 8th, the very last slide, or very close to the very last slide you're going to see in this class, I'm going to show you the same question. And what I'd like you to think about is whether your experiences over these 14 weeks valuing your own company changes your choice. And I'm not pushing in one direction or the other. You might start off by saying, hey, discounted cash flow valuation must be right. Everybody does it. It's in the books. And after 14 weeks of wrestling with it, you might decide it's not for you. So think about this through this class because again, there's no slam dunk choice. I'm not going to say DCF is better than relative valuation because it really depends on your perspective and what you have to do. So now let me do the last and final approach in valuation. If there's anything that's new in valuation, there's very little that is new. It's the application of option pricing in the context of valuing businesses and assets. Remember that option pricing session in Foundations? What makes options unique is your cash flows are contingent on something happening, right? Your price has to exceed your strike price. If it's a call option, it's dropped below the strike price. If it's a put option. So basically, here are the characteristics of options. First, they derive their value from some underlying asset. They're leeches. They can't exist on their own. Second, the payoff is contingent on something happening. Third, they have a finite life. And over the last 45 years in finance, we have developed a lot of option pricing models. And among all financial pricing models, they tend to work best simply because they have to do the least, right? Because you take the underlying assets price as a given, it's all at the margin. It's based on arbitrage and replication, all that neat stuff that creates option pricing models. Now, I'll tell you what we're not going to do in this class. We're not going to revisit payoff diagrams, but I'm going to use payoff diagrams as my starting point for explaining why I call something an option, whether it's a patent or whether it's a natural resource, an undeveloped natural resource. So you're going to see this payoff diagram. And if you remember, what makes options unique is that kink, right, at the strike price, where you cannot lose more than what you paid up front. So it's finite losses, potentially, not necessarily infinite profits, but very large profits. And that is central to understanding what drives the value of options. Because your losses are limited and your profits are unlimited, it turns out that when you buy an option, risk becomes your ally. Do you see why? Because normally when you invest in something, risk is a bad thing. It pulls down the value. But with an option, risk is a good thing because I've limited your losses. So here are the things that I'm not going to value because this is for an option pricing class. I'm not going to value listed options. I'm not going to value warrants. I'm not going to value contingent value rights. I'm not going to value convertible bonds. I'm going to let the options class deal with anything that is actually an option. So you're saying, what exactly are we going to do with option pricing? I'm going to use option pricing to value some businesses that otherwise I would not have been able to value. I'll give you a few examples. Let's suppose I came to you with a troubled airline, which probably is saying the same thing twice, right? But there's some periods airlines look healthy, but most airlines around the world are troubled. And it's so troubled that every financial indicator for this airline is horrible. It's losing money. It's huge amounts of debt, could go bankrupt at any moment. I will argue that equity in deeply troubled companies, where you have a lot of debt, takes on the characteristics of call option. You're so far underwater that there's really nothing more to lose than go out and take more risk. So I'm going to argue that those kinds of stocks are better valued using options. Second, I gave you the example of Petrobras. Lots of undeveloped reserves. Essentially, when you're investing in Petrobras, you're betting on the Brazilian election on one hand, but you're also betting that those undeveloped reserves will be valuable in the future. What makes them options? If the price of oil goes up, those reserves are worth a lot. If they go down, they could be worth nothing. So you could argue that a gold mining company, an oil company, any natural resource company has some optionality, some more than others. Third, there are some very young biotech companies with no revenues, no earnings, but a promising product working its way through the pipeline, through the FDA pipeline. It might get approved, it might not get approved. There are lots of barriers it has to get over. But if it does get approved, it could be a hepatitis drug or a diabetes drug, it could be a blockbuster. I will argue again that with those stocks, you're buying options again. And sometimes, if you're a company that has an exclusive right to do something in a big market, I give you the exclusive right to supply something across China. Even though that right might be worthless right now because it's not viable, it's an option. I have to value that as an option. So those are the cases where we're going to use options. This is what falls under the rubric of real options in valuation. And towards the end of this class, we will spend a few sessions talking about how to apply option pricing in the context of valuation. Justin?
The overall concept, totally agree with. Yeah. A little bit of an issue with the last one, because isn't it possible to basically expand into a new market and fail miserably, sort of similar to what Target did in Canada?
Isn't it possible to buy an out-of-the-money option?
But there's downside to that, right? It's unlimited downside.
No, but basically what you do is, it is true, but at the time of the decision, you have to do a net present value, right? So what I'm saying is if your net present value is negative, you won't go in. Once you go in, then the optionality is gone. So it's actually until you enter the market that there's an option. The minute you enter the market, then all bets are off. Then I'm going to treat it like any other valuation, but risk is now a bad thing. And so it's actually, there's this point at which it goes from being an option to an actual cash flow generating asset. Then it flips and goes back to being a traditional discounted cash flow valuation. So here's the way to think about it. Okay? The reason I bring options, and I'm very reluctant to bring my option tools out of my toolkit, is it's intimidating, right? For most people, you pull options out, they say, oh my God, this is... Okay? So I'm very reluctant. I don't bring it out till I absolutely have to. Is there are some stocks which I will not be able to value without an option pricing model. So I use it because I get desperate. You give me that trouble airline, I try DCF, it's worth nothing. I try relative valuation, I can't even apply a multiple to anything because everything is negative. Desperation time, I have to use options. It also gives us fresh insight when you have optionality as to what drives value. We talked about risk. Right, so risk, instead of being a bad thing, becomes a good thing. Having the exclusive right to a very risky market is worth more than having the exclusive right to a very safe market. The more unpredictable things get, the higher the value of the company. So as we go through this class, think about those things because option pricing models have their place, but I think some people overuse them. They use them everywhere. They're designed for use in very restrictive areas in valuation. What are the disadvantages? All of the option pricing models that are out there were developed for classic listed options, and I'll go further. Most of the option pricing models, whether it's Black-Scholes or binomial, were designed for short-term listed options. So if I give you a three-month call option in IBM trading the CBOE, the Black-Scholes model works great. The options we're going to be valuing are going to be different on many dimensions. They're going to be much more long-term. The right to an undeveloped reserve you might get for 20 years, so it's much more long-term. The underlying asset might not be priced, as in the case of a patent. So you don't get that S in the model. How the heck are you going to use an option pricing model? And the principles of arbitrage and replication that we need to use option pricing models will sometimes break down. The way I describe it is if you're an option purist, you will never be able to use real options because it'll freak you out because you're pushing the model to its breaking point and beyond. But in a sense, you have to do that with real options because you will not be able to get those assumptions working for you. Second, I've heard people say, can I use option pricing instead of DCF? It's not an either or. You have to do a discounted cash flow valuation first in order to do an option pricing. It's an addendum rather than an alternative. So it's not a question of can I do one instead of the other. You've got to do one on top of the other. And finally, I've seen analysts use options in a subjective way to explain away why a company trades at a high price. So they'll value a pharmaceutical company and come up with a number lower than the prices. But that's okay. They have a lot of patents out there. And we know patents. I read in my book somewhere that patents are like options that'll make up the difference. You've got to be very careful. If you bring your option technology into the valuation, you can't double count. So if you decide to count a patent as an option, you can't count the growth in your revenues that will come from developing the patent in your cash flows, because that's a recipe for double counting. And again, we'll come back and talk about the specifics. It's easy to fall into all of those ditches as you go along. So make sure you're not double counting. So if you look across the models, and here's what I want you to think about. And as you look at other people's valuations, start with this question. Is this a DCF valuation? Is it a relative valuation? Is it a contingent claim valuation? And remember that the three approaches differ philosophically. And the reason I emphasize this is when we talk about, and we'll come back and talk about IPO valuations, I often see investment banks do IPO valuations where they take a DCF valuation and a relative valuation and average across the two numbers. You can't do that. That's like saying, you know, I'll be vegetarian in the morning and I'll eat meat in the afternoon and the average, it doesn't work that way, right? So you have to make some choices philosophically. If you're going to do an intrinsic valuation, do an intrinsic valuation. If you're going to do a relative valuation, do a relative valuation. But never the twain shall meet. They're different approaches philosophically to valuation. Zubin?
So you mentioned exclusive licensure. What if it's,
yeah, that's actually a good question, because there's a 0-1, right? Zero is you have absolutely no exclusivity. One is if you have absolute exclusivity. Now you're saying, what if I have partial exclusivity? What can that come from? Brand name, for instance, gives you partial exclusivity, right? So you can think of barriers to entry as falling somewhere in that continuum between 0 and 1. One is you get the full value of the option. Zero is you get no value. Partial barriers to entry, you get portions of that value. So one of the judgments we've got to make is, if you have partial protection against competition, how close do you get to the total option value? But it's really not a 0-1 scenario. It could be somewhere in the middle. In fact, you can think of that of barriers to entry as falling in that continuum from very low to very high barriers to entry. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So that's the end of the intro packet. Now we're on to the first valuation packet. So. So now we're into the meat and potatoes evaluation. The entire first packet, which will take us through about session 13. There are three packets for this class. Only the first one is ready right now. Second one should be ready by next week. The first packet covers just intrinsic valuation. Okay? So let's start with the essence of intrinsic value. And I'm going to repeat what I said. In intrinsic valuation, you try to value an asset based on its expected cash flows, growth, and risk. That's the essence of intrinsic valuation. And discounted cash flow valuation is one tool to estimate intrinsic value. The reason I say that is people use the words interchangeably. Intrinsic value, DCF value, aren't they the same thing? DCF valuation, done right, is an intrinsic valuation approach, but it's not the only one. There might be other ways in which you can estimate intrinsic value. I'll give you a very simplistic way. You can say accounting book value is my estimate of intrinsic value. That takes a lot of faith in accountants to do that. But so there are different ways of thinking about intrinsic value, but discounted cash flow valuation is perhaps the most widely used tool for estimating intrinsic value. So let's start with the essence of discounted cash flow valuation. You can make these models, as I said, as complex as you want, but here's the basic point. The value of an asset is the present value of the expected cash flows in the asset. In classic discounted cash flow valuation, here's what we do. We estimate the expected cash flows, not the best case, not the worst case, not conservative, but the expected cash flows. And I'm going to emphasize that because often people try to be conservative in their cash flow estimates. Don't do that, because then you're going to be in deep trouble at the end of the process because I'm not sure what you've estimated. So get the expected cash flows, which means you're looking across all scenarios and you're coming up with an expected cash flow. In theory, we should be listing all the possible scenarios and taking an expected value across them. In practice, we almost never do that, right? So we'll come back and deal with that, because in discounted cash flow valuation, the cash flows are expected cash flows. The discount rate is where we bring in risk. So the riskier the cash flow is, the higher the discount rate. And we have all these different models we've developed to how to adjust the discount rate. So that's classic discounted cash flow valuation. Expected cash flows in the numerator, risk-adjusted discount rate in the denominator. Here's a less common variant of discounted cash flow valuation. You might never run into this over your lifetime, but just in case you do, here's the other way I can do discounted cash flow valuation. I can replace the expected cash flows with certainty equivalent cash flows. You think, what the heck does that even mean? Let's assume that you have an expected cash flow of $100 next year, and it's risky. And I said, look, I'll give you a guaranteed cash flow in return. If you give me that expected cash flow, I'll give you a guaranteed cash flow. I know Bill Silber probably does this at the start of, of the foundations class. So how much would you take as that guaranteed cash flow? If you're risk neutral, you know what you'll demand, right? If you're risk neutral, what would you demand? If your expected cash flow is 100, you'll demand 100. But we're not risk neutral, at least most of us are. So you're probably going to say, I'll settle for 80 or 85 or 90 because it's guaranteed instead of that. How much you'll settle for will depend on how risk averse you are. The more risk averse you are, the less I need to offer you as a guaranteed cash flow to make up for that expected cash flow. So if you're willing to do this, here's how you can get the value of an asset. You can take all of the expected cash flows for a company. You can come up with certainty equivalents. And you can already see why most people don't even try to do this. So take these and replace them. And because your cash flows are now risk adjusted, guess what you use as your discount rate? Use the risk-free rate. Certainty equivalent cash flows, risk-free rate. I'll give you a little tangent here, because it might help you understand something that puzzles a lot of people doing discounted cash flow valuation. I don't know whether you're familiar with what Warren Buffett says he uses as his discount rate. He's very clear he doesn't use beta. In fact, he tells the world that he actually uses the risk-free rate as his discount rate. You see, if Warren Buffett does it, I can do it too. But here's what he uses when he looks at earnings and cash flows. He looks at only the earnings and cash flows he feels he can count on. You see what he's doing? He's essentially replacing earnings with a certainty equivalent. Of course, there's a lot of mystery about how exactly he comes up with that number. But if you adjust the cash flow for risk, then it's okay. You can use the risk-free rate. What you cannot do is both. You know what I mean by both? You use a certainty equivalent. Use a conservative cash flow, which is what a certainty equivalent often is. And you use a risk-adjusted discount rate on those cash flows. You've double counted risk. So that's the starting point for discounted cash flow valuation, is recognizing that all we're trying to do is come up with that equation. That's what 25 sessions of this class, coming up with the numerator and denominator for that equation. So I'm going to do an experiment that I actually do for the first year. How many of you were in that boot camp that I ran? So you can't participate because you've seen these experiments, right? So I sit back and watch the fun, right? So I'm going to pick somebody who's never done a valuation in their life. Anybody want to be the guinea pig? You've done it in corporate finance, right? Well, let's pick somebody who feels very uncertain about this process. Anybody want to be the guinea pig for that? I promise you'll feel really good after this first test. You say, I get this. No? Okay, I'm going to pick somebody at random. He made my life. So, Joanna, you're going to be my guinea pig. You guys can bring your nameplates. It'll help me too. So here's an empty envelope. I'm not a magician, so I'm not doing it. I'm not David Copperfield, so nothing's happening, right? I'm taking a $20 bill. Fold it at the end, so let me fix that. I'm going to put this in the envelope. How much would you pay for this envelope? Don't think too long. This is what gets us into trouble, is trying to be... How much? First rule in valuation, if you pay $20 for an envelope of $20, what do you walk away with? Just the envelope, right? And unless you value the envelope, so let's start again. How much are you willing to pay for the envelope? Remember, you're not bidding against anybody yet, right?
$1.
Good. Start with a dollar. You know, for all you know, I might have some serious, just like dyslexia, maybe I have a version where I can't read numbers. And I might sell it to you for $1. Of course, that's very unlikely. If I open this up to bidding, at the end of the bidding process, it's going to converge on 20 because this is one of those assets which, unless you're Wass, Sistine, Perella, you should have no trouble valuing, right? So you got $20. Everybody with me so far? So at the end of the bidding, We're at $20. Now, I'm going to, Jeremy, what does that say?
Control.
I'm going to put this in the envelope. How much did you pay for the envelope now?
$20.
But there's control in there.
What does that get me?
Well, let me see the back. 20%. How many of you worked in M&A over the summer? Do you guys do this? You do a valuation, then you add 20%. You call it a control premium. What the heck is that? It's control. It's a 3x5 card. So it's still just a card, right? So if you'd offered me 24, you know what I'd have done? I'd have sold it to you for 24. And you'd have paid $4 for a 3x5 card. And I tell you, even at Staples on a very expensive deck, you're not paying $4 for a 3x5 card. You kind of get this now, right? So, Sandeep, what does this say?
Synergy.
Ah, that's a big one, right? Let me put that in there. How much did you pay for this now? It's got synergy in there. I could paint pictures. I could give you, you know.
Randy.
You're a tough crowd. Yeah? Any marketing people here? You don't want to admit to it, right? Okay. Subhasa, right? What does it say?
Brand name.
Brand name. Okay, I'm going to put that in there. You're a marketing person. You're doing flips in the air. Brand name. That should be adding premiums in. But it's still a 3x5 card. What about this one? What does it say?
Buffett likes me.
It's a $20 bill that Buffett likes. That should buy more stuff than a $20 bill that he doesn't like, right? How often do you see people buying companies? Well, Buffett likes the company. I should buy the company too. It's still a 3x5. So I'm going to pull out my trump cards. It's a little unfair, but I'll try this anyway. What does it say?
Strategic consideration.
For those of you in my corporate finance class, you know exactly what I think about the word strategic, right? You heard the word strategic. You know what it means. The numbers don't fly, but I really, really, really want to do this, right? Strategic. A strategic deal is a really stupid deal. A strategic buyer is an insanely stupid buyer who's already made up his mind that he wants to buy a company before he comes to the bargaining table. Okay? If you're selling a business, try to find a strategic buyer. But still, only a 3x5 card. So now I pull out my final trump card. What does it say?
China.
That does it, right? Now you're paying $40, $50, $60. Why China's in there? Because your mind is doing the math, right? Billion times, you know, 100. Everything gets magnified by a billion. I call these weapons of mass distraction. Because they come out after you've done the valuation. They come out because people want to do something and the numbers don't fly, which is what your valuation did, and they want to do it anyway. So I'll send you my, in fact, I have a blog post on my favorite weapons of mass distraction, my 5 most favorite words. You've seen a couple of them here. And here's what I do. Whenever I see a valuation, I count the words. Strategic. How many times does it get mentioned? China. 17 Chinas and 35 strategics later. You know this guy's pulling bullshit over. And there's no way. The numbers don't fly. That's why these words come out. So if you don't believe me, watch for those words. And when you see those words, you're going to see very quickly that the numbers really don't matter. That's why they want you to get, they basically want to get this deal done, this acquisition, this project, whatever it is. I call this the it proposition. Why do I call it the it proposition? Because if it does not affect the expected cash flows and it does not affect risk, it does not affect value. What's it? You name it. Brand name, synergy, control. So I'm not saying control doesn't have value. What am I saying? If you're going to talk about control, what do you have to do? What's the obligation you're under? Tell me what you're going to do with control. How is it going to affect the cash flows? How is it? Then we can talk about the value of control. I'm not saying synergy doesn't have value, but I'm saying if you use the word synergy, I'm going to put the onus back on you. Synergy in what sense? You're going to grow faster, you're going to have lower costs. Let's put it in the cash flows. But if you say, look, it's too fuzzy, I can't put it into the cash flows or the risk, that doesn't fly with me because you're paying with real dollars, not fuzzy dollars, right? So in a sense, you've got to decide up front what you're going to do. The second proposition I call the Duh proposition, named after my daughter, who's now 19. have four kids, and for those of you who have kids or plan to have kids, here's something that's going to happen. Around the age of two, they think you know everything on the face of the earth. They ask you questions like, what's the meaning of the universe? And you can, the nice thing is you can make up answers. They have no way of checking. They can't read Wikipedia yet. And around the between the ages of two and three, though, something very, very bad tends to happen. They wake up, and you magically know less than you did the previous day. And then it's all downhill from that day on to about 16 when you hit complete and total rock bottom. You've reached a point where you know nothing, you being the parent. So this was actually when my daughter reached the age of 16, I hit rock bottom. I was the stupidest person walking the face of the earth. In fact, at dinner, I'd open my mouth. I wouldn't even have to say anything. She said, Dad, duh. It's like, shut up, Dad. Why are you even talking? So I named this the duh proposition because it reflects some of the emails I get about valuation. Here's how the emails will go. I'm valuing a company. It's a money-losing company. I expected to lose money forever. What valuation model should I use to value this company? I feel like walking up to the person, slapping them around the face. So wake up. You have a money-losing company, expect you to lose money forever. You're thinking about paying for this company. What's wrong with you? So the duh proposition says, if you're going to value something, hope and pray the cash flows turn positive at some point in time. Doesn't have to be tomorrow. Doesn't have to be five. But at some point in time, you need positive cash flows. In fact, the third proposition I'm going to call the don't freak out proposition. And that's for those of you who are going to come out in the next week or two freaking out into my office. And here's what's going to happen. You'd have picked a company, you'll estimate the cash flows for next year, and the cash flows will be negative. And you say, oh my God, something is wrong here. And what I'm trying to say is, it's okay. That's all that happens. So I'll preempt that office visit. When you come in, here's all I'm going to tell you. It's okay. You can have negative cash flows next year, 2 years out, 3 years out, as long as you get disproportionately large positive cash flows in the future. See why they have to be disproportionate? You lose $1 billion in year one. You're going to make $10 billion back in year 10 to make up for that billion. In fact, what kinds of companies are you going to get negative cash flows up front? Two groups of companies, very young companies or very old companies. At either end of the life cycle, pray and hope it's not the very old company, right? That's on the verge of going under. Very young companies will have negative cash flows, not just because they're losing money, but because they have to reinvest so much to grow. In fact, if you see a young growth company valuation where the cash flows are positive right from year one, you know something is not right here. So if you have a startup you want to value, and you want me to believe your valuation, don't show me cash flows that are positive right from year one. Say, look how good we look right off the bat, because there's something wrong with your story then. It's not flying. It's not consistent with those cash flows. So keep that in mind as we go through, because I'm going to now set up what we started class today, which is when you sit down to value a business, you have to make a choice. You have to decide whether you're going to value the entire business or just the equity in the business. Sounds like I'm splitting hairs, but here's the reason. Here's the way to think about it. This is, again, something you might remember from corporate finance. When I think of a company, I think of it in terms of a financial balance sheet rather than an accounting balance sheet. And in a financial balance sheet, the way I break down assets is not into fixed and current and financial and intangible, but into assets in place. These are investments you've already made as a company, and growth assets. These are investments I expect you to make in the future. So if you're a company like LinkedIn, the bulk of your value will come from growth assets, not from assets in place. But if you're a company like Procter & Gamble, the bulk of your value comes from assets in place. Nothing good or bad about it, but that's where you are in the life cycle. And on the other side of the balance sheet, there are only two ways you can fund a business. You can borrow the money, which is debt, or use your own money, which is equity. So the first choice you have to make in valuation is you have to decide whether you're going to value the entire business or value the equity in the business. In fact, to understand the distinction, let me ask you a question. Can you have a valuable business where equity is worth nothing? Absolutely, right? Can you be living in a valuable house where you have no equity in the house? Sure. You bought the house in 2007, which was $3 million. It's now dropped to $1.5 million. You have a valuable house, but your equity is gone. So the next time you hear about a company in trouble, remember we're talking about the equity in the company. It doesn't mean that the assets of the company are worth nothing. It's that the equity has gone to zero and perhaps beyond. So that's the first choice you have to make. We'll come back and talk about how to make that choice, but you have to decide whether you're valuing the equity in the business of valuing the entire business. And here's why it matters. If you decide to value the equity in a business, you got to be focused on just the equity investors. In what sense? The cash flows you have to estimate are cash flows to equity investors after debt payments. And the discount rate you use should be the cost of equity, which reflects the rate of return that equity investors demand for investing in the equity. In fact, in one very strict sense of the word, you can argue that the only cash flow you get as an equity investor from a publicly traded company is what? Is dividend. The dividend discount model is a special case of an equity valuation model, where you take the dividends, discount them back at the cost of equity. So equity valuation, you're wearing blinders. All you care about are cash flows to equity, cost of equity, you've got the value of the equity. In contrast, when you're valuing the entire business, the cash flow you're looking at are the collective cash flows that equity investors get and lenders. It's very counterintuitive because you're thinking about the lenders as partners in this game. You're looking at pre-debt cash flows. You discount those cash flows back at a weighted average of what the equity investors want, which is the cost of equity, and what the lenders want, which is the cost of debt, which, of course, in corporate finance, we label the cost of capital. You take the cash flows to the business, you discount back at the cost of capital, you get the value of the entire business. If you're still interested in equity, you can still get there, right? Just subtract out the outstanding debt in the company, and you got the value of equity. So you can get to equity two ways. One is directly by taking cash flows to equity. The other is by valuing the business and subtracting our debt. And if you've done valuation, you've probably at least done some firm valuation. We've got to that stage of subtracting our debt. So I have a very simple methodological question. Let's assume you value the entire business and you want to get to equity value. You have to subtract our debt, right? So I'm going to give you some choices as to what you should be subtracting, and you tell me which one you should pick as your choice for what you subtract out from firm value to get to equity value. You could subtract out the value of just long-term debt. You could subtract out the value of all debt. You could subtract out the value of whatever you call debt in your cost of capital. Now you might say, what's the distinction? It's all the same thing. Might be, it might not be. Or you can subtract out all liabilities, which would include things like accounts payable, supplier credit, which would be far larger than just interest-bearing debt. Long-term debt, all interest-bearing debt, whatever you call debt in your cost of capital, are all liabilities. Think about it for just a few seconds and circle what you think is the right answer. First, how many of you chose long-term, just long-term debt? I picked all four because I've seen all four done in discounted cash flow valuations. They're obviously not all four right. I see a lot of people using only long-term debt, and I don't quite get that. I mean, debt is debt. What does it matter whether it's short-term or long-term? And by playing this game of just long-term debt, you're opening the door to all kinds of strange things for companies to do, right? Replace long-term debt with short-term debt. All interest-bearing debt, I think that's a legitimate contender. But usually what makes B and C different, and if you remember your corporate finance, what else did we add to debt when we did cost of capital that was not in? We added to the present value of leases, which means that if you include that as debt in your cost of capital, when you get to this stage in the process, guess what? You have to be subtracting that out as well. So C is, in fact, the right answer. And that's actually a good thing because it means whatever you thought about as debt in your cost of capital will now come out of the value of the firm to get to value of equity. So if you decide not to include leases in debt, that's fine. But then don't include leases in debt in both places. You decide to include leases in debt, including the cost of capital, and when you subtract out to get to value of equity. Do not subtract out all liabilities, accounts payable, supplier credit, etc. Because even though it might sound conservative, it's not right. If you decide to treat accounts payable and supplier credit as debt in your cost of capital, then it's okay. But we'll talk about why that's difficult to do. So the answer is C, but hold on to that thought as we go through this process, because it is going to make your life easier. Because that choice up front is going to drive your choice at the end. Let me ask you a follow-up question. Let's say you value equity in a company by taking cash flows to equity and discounting the cost of equity. You come up with the value. Then you value the entire firm and you subtract out the debt to get a value of equity. Same company, same point in time, same information, right? Will you get the same value for equity by taking cash flows to equity and discounting the cost of equity as you will if you value the business and subtract out debt? Let me ask you a different question. Would you like to get the same answer? I certainly would, because think of the problems it's going to create for you. If you tell me the company looks cheap on an equity basis, but looks expensive on a firm. What does it even mean? Because you're buying shares in the company. It's either cheap or it's expensive. So at least in theory, you'd like to get the same answer, right? I told you about the weekly challenges. You don't remember, right? Amazing how quickly you forget things. The first weekly challenge will go out after class today. And the first weekly challenge is precisely about this question about the value of equity. And when you do it for the first time, you actually won't get the same value of equity. And I want you to dig through the problem to see what it is that causes you to get different answers. Because if you do it right, you should get the same value for the equity either way. But doing it right is very difficult to do. I'll give you a made-up example to show you that they converge. But it's completely made up. And I confess up front that it's completely made up. I had to make some assumptions along the way to make the equity values converge. So this is a firm where I was valuing the equity in the firm, and I was valuing the firm and subtracting our debt to get to value of equity. You're going to see the same value for equity, but it's because I've made up the example to get the same values. So here are the cash flows to equity. Those are the cash flows to the firm. Okay. The cost of equity for this firm is 13.625%, and the pre-tax cost of debt is 10%. Market value of equity is $1.073 billion. Market value of debt is $800. So I'm going to value this firm with the cash flows given, and I've got the terminal values too. First, by taking cash flows to equity and discounting the cost of equity. So I take the cash flow to equity each year, $50 million in year one, $60 million in year two, discount back at 13.625%, which is my cost of equity. The value of equity that I get is $1.073 billion. So the company is fairly priced. I value the firm. I take the after-tax cost of debt, 5%. I come up with a cost of capital of 9.94%. I discount the cash flows to the entire firm back at the cost of capital. The value that I get for the firm is $1.873 billion. I subtract out the debt. I get a value for the equity. This is great, right? The numbers converge. But as I said, I cheated. I cheated not in the sense that I've cooked the numbers, but I've made an implicit assumption here that allowed me to converge. And what I'd like you to think about is what that assumption is on the weekly challenge. Because if you get that, you're starting to unlock the secret as to why different valuation approaches sometimes can give you different answers. In fact, if you use any other combination, you're going to screw up, as you saw with the Carborundum case. The consistency principle basically says, you tell me how you estimate the cash flows, I'll tell you what discount rate you should use. Cash flows to equity, you discount at the cost of equity. Cash flows to firm, you discount at the cost of capital. The next time you see a DCF valuation, check that out. See if, in fact, the cash flows and the discount rates match up. Okay? Because if they're mismatched, you're going to get an answer that means almost nothing, even if the numbers are right individually. The cash flows can be right and the discount rate can be right, but if they're mismatched, the end value is going to be off. In fact, put an X on this page, because when you're doing your quiz, I don't want you to end up on this page and think this is what you should be doing. What I did was I took every wrong combination I could think of and to see how. Remember, the value that I got is $1.073 million for the equity. If I discounted the cash flow to equity at the cost of capital, which is something I shouldn't be doing, the value that I'd have got for the equity would have been much higher, just like you did in the Carborundum case. Using the cost of capital is going to overstate the value. If I took the cash flow to the firm and discounted the cost of equity, I'm going to get too low a value for the business. And in fact, if I forget to subtract our debt, God only knows what I've got, right? Because, and you can see why it happens, because you're not even sure what you valued, right? Because at one piece you used the firm, the other piece used equity, you're not even sure what the end number is. So be very clear about what you're discounting before you pick a discount rate to apply on that number. So we'll come back to this consistency principle because it's going to be useful in other contexts as well. What currency should I use, should the discount rate be in? You're going to see the same principle kick in. But that's one of the first principles in valuation, is match up your cash flows to your discount rates. Any questions? So let's look at the process of doing discounted cash flow valuation. Essentially, if you look at the setup for a discounted cash flow valuation, the first step is you have to come up with a discount rate. The discount rate can either be a cost of equity or a cost of capital. It can be different currencies. Yesterday, for instance, I put up the ARCA Continental valuation. It's a Mexican company with significant Ecuadorian Argentine risk exposure. That's going to play a role in the valuation. And I chose to do the valuation in Mexican pesos. You say, what do you mean chose to. It's a Mexican company. So we value. I could have valued it in dollars. I could have valued it in whatever currency I want. I chose to do the valuation in pesos. So we're going to talk about how to adjust the discount rate for different currencies. And a point I'm going to make repeatedly through this class is in valuation, you're not stuck with the same discount rate every year in perpetuity. In other words, you get a cost of capital up front. It can change. In fact, it should change over time as your company changes. So if you have a young growth company, it might be all equity funded and have a cost of capital of 14% when you start the process. But by the time you get to year 5 or year 10, the numbers could be very different. So the first step in the process is coming up with those discount rates that match up to how you're going to estimate the cash flows. So step 1 and step 2 have to be done together because they've got to be matched up. Step 3 is where people start to get uncomfortable. Because step 1 and step 2, you can use numbers that you pull off Bloomberg, you can pull them from financial statements. So you're in your comfort zone. Step 3, I ask you about the future. What's the growth going to be? What are future cash flows going to be? What are margins going to look like? But that's if you're going to do a valuation, you have no choice. You have to make your best estimates. And then you have to make a judgment as to when your company will hit what I call stable growth. You know why I need to make that assumption? What did I say the value of an asset was? The present value of the expected cash flows over its lifetime, right? You're valuing a publicly traded company. You look at the corporate charter. It tells you when the company was founded. When does it tell you the company is going to be wound up? It doesn't, right? It could go on and on and on and on forever. So all you need to do to value publicly traded companies, estimate cash flows forever. This is my vision of hell. I show up in hell. I'm pretty pissed off I'm there. But I have no choice. I'm there. I see the devil walking up towards me, dressed up like an investment banker. Don't ask me why. Expensive Barney suit kind of thing. He says, welcome to hell. I don't want to be there. But I have no choice. I'm there. So what do you want me to do? I want you to do some valuation. That's not too bad. That's what I used to do in my regular life. Then he points me towards a laptop, and my vision of hell takes form. It's a Dell. One of those Dells. You know how they thought styling was just changing the back to blue, green, etc. I'm a Mac user. I have to work on a Dell. No, but the Macs are all in heaven, I guess. It's okay. This is the best you can do. What company should I be valuing? It says GE. Now my vision of hell is getting hotter. It's like Groundhog Day. Every day I have to wake up for the rest of eternity valuing GE over and over and over and over again, cursing Jack Welch every step of the way. I ask him a final question. How many years do I have to estimate cash flows? He says forever. It's a spreadsheet that never ends. Imagine 16,484 columns from now, you're still saying cash flow in the next year, cash flow in the next year. No wonder in real life, the question you keep hearing is, can I stop now? Do I have to do another year? And my answer to the question is, you can stop if you're willing to make an assumption. You know what the assumption has to be? If it's a discounted cash flow valuation, you have to assume that beyond that point in time, your cash flows will grow at a constant rate forever. Scary, right? You know what that buys you? When your cash flows grow at a constant rate forever, you get an infinite series. Mathematics. Basically, so write the equation out. So 1 plus g, 1 plus g squared, 1 plus... And 200 years ago in mathematics, they solved the equation for the value of that infinite series. We stole it in finance. We act like we invented this. And of course, the way it shows up is in every valuation, it is that terminal value equation where we essentially capture the present value of all cash flows beyond year 5 or 10 using that perpetual growth model. Do you see why I need to know when your company will be a stable growth company? A stable growth company is a company that grows at a rate less than or equal to the economy. And I need that if I want to make the assumption that that growth rate will continue forever. So it's not an easy question to answer, but it's a question I need the answer to actually bring my model to fruition. So I'm going to show you 3 pictures just to prepare you for what's coming in terms of the actual numbers. I'm not going to spend too much time on each picture, but basically I'm going to argue there are 3 ways you can do valuation. You can go the old-fashioned way and say, look, this cash flow estimation thing is too much work. I'm just going to focus on dividends, discount them back at the cost of equity, come up with the value of equity. In the dividend discount model, your cash flow is dividends paid to stockholders. Your growth rate is growth rate in dividends. and your discount rate is the cost of equity. So file that away. So when I do dividends, cash flows are dividends, growth rate in dividends, discount rate is the cost of equity. But if you remember corporate finance, what's the problem with focusing on dividends? Do companies pay out what they can afford to in dividends? We know conclusively, beyond even the slightest doubt, that they don't. How do we know that? What is it that gives them away? It's not necessarily the payout ratio. The evidence is right there on the balance sheet. All I have to do is look at that number. Your cash balance, right? That gives you away. If you have a $100 million cash balance, you can't say with a straight face that you've been paying out what you can afford to dividends. How the heck did $100 million show up on your balance sheet? Isn't manna from heaven? It's a direct consequence of holding back cash. Now, do you see where I'm going with this? Dividend discount model will tend to understate the value of companies that hold back cash. You value Google with a dividend discount model. You're going to run into trouble sooner or later. In fact, it pays no dividend at all. In fact, I got an email a couple of weeks ago from somebody, a few months ago actually, from somebody who's using the Gordon growth model to value Google. You know what the Gordon growth model is? It's a stable growth dividend discount model. He said, the model's not working. I keep getting zero. And my response was a little cruel, but I had to send it anyway. I said, using a Gordon growth model to value Google is like using a hammer to do surgery. It's going to be bloody, and it's not going to be very effective. And you really have to think about getting a scalpel here. So dividend discount models have their use, and we'll use them in some very small subsets of companies. But I'm going to replace the dividend discount model more generically with the cash flow model, which allows me to capture what the company can pay out. So if you look at any discounted cash flow model, you're going to get cash flows, you're going to get a growth rate. You're going to get a point in time, your company becomes a mature company, and you come up with a discount rate. What you use is what's going to vary across the model. So with the dividend discount model, the cash flow is dividends. But if I switch to a potential dividend discount model, then I have the obligation of estimating what you could have paid in dividends. That's what I call my free cash flow equity, right? And remember, the whole idea of an estimating free cash flow equity is to look at what a company could have paid in dividends. So if you value it based on potential dividends, you're going to focus on free cash flow equity. You're going to look at the growth in free cash flow equity. You're going to still discount back at the cost of equity. Whereas if you value the entire firm, the cash flows you're going to be looking at are pre-debt cash flows. That's the free cash flow to the firm. You're going to discount those cash flows back at the cost of capital. And what you end up with as your value will be the value of the operating assets of the company. And the reason I set this table up is we think of these models as very different, but think of how much they share in common. They're trying to do the same thing. The only difference is what lens you wear in looking at a company. So this is a classic dividend discount model. Start with the dividends, you get an expected growth rate in dividends, you discount back at the cost of equity, you're done. You got the value of equity in the company. So if I gave you a bank to value, you say, this is what I'm going to do. Dangers all over the place, but think of how easy it is because you're going to focus on just the dividends paid. If you use a free cash flow equity model, so as I said, for the moment, if you're still fuzzy about these things, you're going to say, well, I don't even get some. We'll come back and talk about the specifics. I just want you to think about the big picture. If I replace dividends with free cash flow equity, all I'm doing is I then have the obligation of estimating what could have been paid out. Sounds like a difficult thing to do, right? But potential dividends is whatever cash you've left over after you've met every conceivable need, CapEx, working capital, debt payments, principal, preferred dividend, whatever you have to pay out. What's left in the till is free cash flow equity. In a free cash flow equity model, rather than look at dividends, I'm looking at potential dividends. Rather than look at growth in dividends, I look at growth in free cash flow equity. I still discount back at the cost of equity because it's an equity cash flow. I still have an assumption about stable growth. I get a value for equity in the company. And finally, in a firm valuation model, I look at the total cash flows before debt payments, before interest payments, before principal payments. I estimate a growth in those free cash flows over time. And I discount back at the cost of capital, I get a value for the operating assets of the company. Why operating assets? Because the only cash flows I've counted are the assets that are counted in operating income, right? What have I not valued it? I haven't valued cash. I haven't valued cross holdings. So a whole bunch of loose ends we'll come back and talk about because you've got to mop those up before you get to the value of equity. But dividend, so when you get a chance, just put these three models next to each other so you can see what they share in common. And over the rest of the class, we'll fill in the details about how you get from dividends to free cash flow to equity, from free cash flow to equity to free cash flow to the firm. Because if you can go back and forth across the models, you're going to be fine. So let me at least start on the input stage in the process. Okay. Let's start with this context. And I'm going to start with a statement that I'm going to back up. I think we spend far too much time on discount rates and valuation and too little time on the cash flows. And if you've ever done valuation in a bank or in a consulting firm, think about it. Think of how much time you spent refining the beta and the risk premium and the risk-free rate and the cost of debt and the debt ratio. And think of how much time you spent thinking about margins and growth rates and potential markets. And it's very disproportionate. You spend 70% of your time on the discount rate. It matters, but it doesn't matter as much as we think it does. You know why we like working with discount rates? It gives us this illusion of control. I got the beta from Bloomberg. Look, I changed the beta from weekly to monthly. Oh, that this must be much better. Let it go. Discount rates are not where you're going to screw up on evaluations and the cash flow. But I want to spend some time on discount rates because intuitively the starting point is that issue of consistency. You tell me how you estimate cash flows, I'll tell you what the right discount rates. We've already talked about, are your cash flows equity cash flows or firm cash flows? That's going to drive whether you use cost of equity or cost of capital. Tell me what currency your cash flows are in. If my cash flows are in Mexican pesos, my discount rate has to be in Mexican pesos. If my cash flows are in US dollars, my discount rate has to be in US dollars. And remember, you get to do both. So don't tell me I don't know what currency the cash flows are in, because if you don't, you're in big trouble. And finally, you do have this choice of taking currency entirely out of the process. Currencies matter because they bring inflation rates into your valuation. You know what I mean by that? When I pick pesos as opposed to Swiss francs, I'm picking a higher inflation versus a lower inflation rate, which affects both my cash flows and my discount rate. I can take currencies entirely out of the process by choosing to value my company in real terms. Most people in the US and Europe never ever do a real valuation, but in Latin America, this is not uncommon. Where effectively you look at what your cash flows would be, ignoring inflation, you come up with a discount rate that's built on those real cash flows, a real discount rate, and you do a valuation based on that match. But you tell me how the cash flows are estimated, I'll tell you what discount rate is right for those cash flows. So let's start with the discount rate process. I'm again going to set it up in very simplistic terms because I think, again, we allow ourselves to bring too many complications to the process. To get a discount rate for a company, a risk-adjusted cost of equity, I need a risk-free rate, right? That should be easy. I wish it were. It's not that simple, but I need a risk-free rate. Then I need a measure of relative risk of the company I'm looking at. Is it more risky or less risky than the average company? And of course, if you've gone through a finance class, we brainwashed you into thinking beta is the only way to think about that. But there are lots of different ways. So when you think about beta, to me, what it does is it captures the relative risk of your company. So when you say beta is 2 for your company, you're saying your company is twice as risky as the average company in the market. We'll talk about alternatives. If you don't like betas, what you can use instead, times an equity risk premium for the average risk equity. Risk-free rate, relative risk measure, risk premium. And if you think about risk and return models, that's basically what we're trying to grapple with. Now, one thing I'm going to suggest you do as soon as you pick a company is start creating a risk profile. You know what I mean by risk profile? Think about every conceivable risk that could affect your company. And if you're comprehensive, that list is going to run, you know, maybe 2 pages long. It could be 35 things you worry about. I worry about this. But once you've got that list going, start putting your risk into buckets. Let me explain. Your risk can be either estimation uncertainty or economic uncertainty. You say, what's the difference? Estimation uncertainty is because you haven't done your job well enough. You haven't collected the data that's out there. Economic uncertainty, you have no control over. You can collect every piece of information on the face of the earth, but economic uncertainty is still going to be there. What's an example? You have to value a Ukrainian company. You think just because you build a bigger spreadsheet, the uncertainty is going to go away? 90% of the uncertainty you're going to face in valuation, especially with young growth companies or emerging market companies, is going to be economic uncertainty. And that should take a weight off your shoulders, because often you're thinking, if only I do more work, I collect more data, my numbers are going to go get more precise. That works only on that 10%. The remaining 90% is out of your control. So is it estimation uncertainty or economic uncertainty? Let economic uncertainty go. There's nothing you can do about it. Second, is it micro uncertainty or macro uncertainty? Micro uncertainty is uncertainty you feel about your company. Right? What will the margins be? What will the, you know. So it's what your company does, how it operates in its marketplace. That's micro uncertainty. What's macro uncertainty? What will happen to interest rates? What will happen to inflation? What will happen to the economy? So is the uncertainty you're thinking about uncertainty about your company, uncertainty about the economy? You're saying, who cares? Which of those two uncertainties show up in your discount rate? Micro or macro? If you're a diversified investor, what happens to micro uncertainties? They average out because you have 100 companies. Micro uncertainties cut in both ways. We can come back and debate how well we do that. But macro uncertainty is the uncertainty shown in your discount rate. And finally, is it discrete uncertainty or continuous uncertainty? What's continuous uncertainty? You invest in a company with foreign operations. Every time exchange rates change, your value is changing, right? Because your cash flows are changing. What's discrete uncertainty? Maria is going to value a Venezuelan company. It's always scary, valuing a Venezuelan or Argentine company. There's a lot of discrete uncertainty, which is, hey, what if my company ceases to exist, either voluntarily or involuntarily, right? Nationalization risk. Is it discrete uncertainty? Terrorism risk. Is it discrete uncertainty? Default risk. Is it discrete uncertainty? And I make a confession, in finance, we're very good at dealing with continuous risk. We're not very good at dealing with discrete risk. So we're going to come back and talk about it. What's the best way to value a company when nationalization risk is the biggest risk you worry about? Or the risk that you might not be able to make it through next year. So think about different kinds of risk, because one of the things I'm going to emphasize is not all risk is made equal. Just because you're worried about something doesn't mean you can pump up the discount rate because your ulcers are forming. That's not what the discount rate is there for. Second, you always have to think when you're doing valuation about risk through whose eyes. What I mean by that is you could look at a company and say, that's really risky to me, but you don't matter. I shouldn't say that. If you have $100 billion in your bank, you do matter. But if you have $100 or $100,000, you don't matter that much. So when we think about risk, we think about risk through the eyes of the marginal investor in this company. Remember the marginal investor in corporate finance? Those are the investors who own a lot of stock and trade that stock. So don't think about how risky is the stock to me. Think about how risky is it to that marginal investor. And finally, the diversification effect has to be brought in there because it can affect the value of your company. If you're not a diversified investor, the same company can look less valuable to you than to somebody else who's more diversified. So those are the things we're going to come back to. And if you look at risk and return models in finance, they essentially all try to do the same thing. They start with a risk-free rate as a base. They try to measure relative risk with a beta or betas. Kappa measures one beta, the arbitrage pricing model or the multi-factor model measures many betas. And proxy models try to evade the question altogether and say, you tell me whether you're a small company or a large company. They try to, but all of them start with a risk-free rate, right? So, which means that if you don't have a risk-free rate, you're screwed. So what I'd like to spend some time on is talking about the risk-free rate, because I think in practice people mangle every single input into the cost of equity. They often use short-term government. I've seen people use table rates as risk-free rates on the strange presumption of, if I'm looking for something truly risk-free over the next day, then I want a one-day table rate. I've seen people use historical risk premiums to come up with cost of equity. You look at the last 75 or 80 years. And of course, people use regression betas like they're going out of style, right? The Bloomberg adjusted beta page goes into your valuation. I'm going to contest every one of those practices, but I want to start with the risk-free rate. So let's start with the risk-free rate. Let me go back to my definition of a risk-free rate. In a risk-free rate, you know exactly what you're going to make on your investment with certainty. There's no uncertainty about it at all. So there are two criteria you've got to meet for something to be risk-free. First, the entity issuing the security cannot have any default risk, not even an iota. Already you can see the crystallization of a problem you're going to face in coming up with risk-free rates, at least in some currencies, right? Argentine pesos, Venezuelan bolivar. And basically, you tell me something. You say, how do I come up with a risk rate? There's nothing that's default free in this currency. We'll have to deal with that. Second, there can be no reinvestment risk. What that effectively means is if you're looking at a cash flow which is coming due in 10 years, a six-month T-bill is not risk-free because there's reinvestment risk, right? So time horizon matters. So if you think about what I've just said, the time horizon, so when you ask me what's the risk-free rate, I can't answer the question until you tell me over what time horizon and in what currency. There is no one universal risk-free rate that I can give out. So one of the challenges we face is coming up with risk-free rates. And it's easier in some currencies than others. But even in the currencies where it's easier, it's more difficult now than it was 6 years ago. We did this in corporate finance, but might as well revisit some of these things. Let's start with US dollars. I want a risk-free rate in US dollars. I'm going to give you a series of choices. And I'll tell you what I'm using this for. I'm using this to do a valuation. So that's going to play a role in what risk-free rate you should pick for me. It's a US dollar valuation. I want a risk-free rate in US dollars. Here are my choices. And as I go through each one, think about why or why not on that choice. A three-month treasury bill rate. What's wrong with that? What am I using this for? Evaluation, where the cash flows are in year one, year two, year three, year four. So short-term T-bill rate is not going to do the trick because it doesn't match up durations, right? A 10-year T-bond rate and a 30-year T-bond rate. Now, if you just were a purist picking based the best risk-free rate, how long do your cash flows last in a typical company valuation? You might stop in year 5 or year 10, but what do you assume after year 5 or year 10? You assume a perpetuity, right? So if I had to pick a pure risk-free rate, I'd pick the 30-year T-bond rate over the 10-year. But I'll tell you the reason I'm going to stick with the 10-year. If I pick a 30-year T-bond rate as my risk-free rate, everything I do has to be based on the 30-year T-bond, and some of those inputs are going to be really difficult to get. I'll give you one example. I want a cost of debt for a company. What do I have to do? I have to find default spreads based on the rating for the company, right? Now, how do I get the default spreads? I find corporate bonds and compare them to T-bonds. So if I pick a 30-year T-bond rate as my risk-free rate, I need to find 30-year corporates and find default spreads. Well, good luck with that. So I'll make an approximation here and accept that it's not the best one. I'm going to go with the 10-year T-bond rate as my risk-free rate. And there are two assumptions I'm making. One is, by using the 10-year T-bond rate, I'm not losing too much because the other inputs will adjust. I have a higher risk premium because of the 10. And the other is, I'm assuming that there is no default risk in the US Treasury. Remember what I said, even in currencies where risk-free rates are easier to get, you see why things are more difficult now than 6 years ago? In 2007, if I said there's no default risk in the US Treasury, I said, of course. Today, if I say no default risk, I'd probably get into an argument with at least a third of the people I talked to, right? There is default risk. Remember that rating fiasco 2 years ago? So when I use the 10-year T-bond rate, I am making the assumption that it's good enough in terms of maturity and also that there's no default risk in the U.S. Treasury. Now, I have two other fourth choice that I'll come back and use somewhere else. But you know what a TIPS rate is? That's the rate on an inflation-protected treasury. What is that really? So how would I read the 1%? What is it telling me? It's giving me a risk-free rate, not in U.S. dollars, but it's a real risk-free rate. So if you wanted a real risk-free rate, there it is, 1%. So that's the first one. Let's try a second one. This is a little messier. I want a risk-free rate in euros. That should be easy, right? Just find a government bond denominated in euros. There they are. Which of these should be my risk-free rate? Certainly not the Greek or the Spanish or the Portuguese, right? Because even using the word risk-free in the context of Greek government bond, you can't even say it in one sentence, right? Greek government bond risk-free, right? So you're going to use the German bond rate as your risk-free rate in euros and use it across any company anywhere in the EU, even if it's a Spanish company or a Greek company. Part of you is saying, but I want to punish that company for being a Greek company. I'll give you plenty of chances. Don't do it in the risk-free rate. In fact, you know what the German 10-year euro bond rate is right now? It actually fell below 1% a couple of weeks ago. The euro risk-free rate is now a little bit below 1%, which is really not good news in valuation if you're valuing in euros, and you'll see why. You think that's good, isn't it? It's going to bring your discount rates down, but it's also going to have other impacts on your valuation that are going to be negative. So euro risk-free rate. Just don't take the government bond rate in that country because it's not going to be risk-free. Let's do one final one, and then we'll take our... Let's say I want a risk-free rate in Indian rupees. On January 1st of 2014, the Indian government bond rate, a rupee bond, make sure you have a local currency bond for this, was 8.83%. January 2014, though, when I looked at the local currency rating for India, just to make sure that it was... I wanted a default-free bond, right? So I have to check to make sure that the rate is default-free. The rating I got for India was Baa3. And the default spread for a typical Baa3 country or sovereign rating in early 2014 was about 2.2%. So what's the risk-free rate in rupees? Let me give you the choices. I can stick with the 8.83%, but what's the problem with that? I'm calling something that has default risk in it risk-free, and it's not, right? I can add the 2.2% to the 8.83, or I can subtract the 2.2% from the 8.83. Which one's a better choice? I want to subtract it out. Do you see why the 8.83% is not risk-free? I want to take out the portion that is due to default risk. And if you trust my numbers, the 2.2%, then I'm going to take the 2.2% out. The risk-free rate in Indian rupees is going to be 6.63%. Now, of course, the tricky part here is getting that default spread, right? Because if you can get that default spread, you can get a risk-free rate in any currency. So next session when we start off, we're going to start off with different ways in which you can estimate the default spread to get it out. In fact, when you get a chance, take a look at the government bond rates in different currencies, and I'll send you a link to do that. But that's what we'll start with next class. Thank you.